It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, winter is coming, and maybe you want to drink some tea. Maybe you don't know where to start with all the varieties on the market. A Wisconsin expert gives us the inside scoop on tea coming up. First, we take a look at the big stories playing out in national politics this week. The U.S. Justice Department is backing President Trump's pick as interim attorney general after criticism from Democrats. Some big election results are still being finalized in Florida and Georgia. And House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi is campaigning within her caucus to regain her former role as House Speaker. Our question for you this week is, what do you want to see from the leaders of either party in Congress? For Democrats, is Nancy Pelosi the smart choice again for House Speaker, or does the party need a change? What direction should new House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy take for Republicans? And how about the Senate? Should there have been changes there? There weren't. But do you think there should have been? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. Reed Wilson is national correspondent at The Hill. Reed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob. How you doing?
Well, pretty good. Now, let's start with this day after Election Day story. Attorney General Jeff Sessions resigned at the request of President Trump. The president appointed Matthew Whitaker to be the acting attorney general. Now, talk about some of the controversy over whether he was eligible to be appointed as attorney general.
Right. So Matthew Whitaker is a political appointee from the state of Iowa. He worked on the Trump campaign. He was then installed as chief of staff under Jeff Sessions for the entire Justice Department. And, you know, that is not a Senate confirmable position to be a political appointee in the Justice Department. And the Democrats say that according to the Constitution, if you're going to be appointed to another cabinet-level position or a Senate-confirmable position, you have to have gone through the Senate confirmation process to begin with. Now, there is another figure at the Department of Justice, the Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, who has been confirmed by the Senate, and ordinarily he would have been the one in line to serve as the acting Attorney General until President Trump appoints somebody new. Now, of course, this has a little added flavor because Matthew Whitaker has been outspoken in his opposition to the Russia investigation. He wrote an op-ed about it for CNN back in 2017, went on Fox News a bunch to talk about his opposition to the Russia investigation. And, of course, as we know, President Trump's favorite place from which to recruit staff happens to be the channel of Fox News. Democrats have a lot of questions about who Matthew Whitaker is now that he is overseeing the Russia investigation and he has taken back that oversight from Rod Rosenstein, and whether or not that's legitimate. Already we've seen some states, including the state of Maryland, has actually filed suit to try to get a federal judge to declare Rod Rosenstein the acting attorney general. It's not clear how fast or whether or not that's going to be adjudicated before there's a new pick. But, you know, President Trump had known for a long time that he was going to get rid of Jeff Sessions. And the fact is, there was just no appointee waiting in the wings.
There's been talk, as you mentioned, of Matthew Whitaker's comments on the Russia probe in the past and some calls, particularly from Democrats, for him to recuse himself for that, as Jeff Sessions had done previously. Is there any indication that the Justice Department is reviewing this idea that he might be recused as Jeff Sessions was?
Well, the Justice Department spokeswoman had said that they will consult with the ethics officials who are, they're sort of career officials who are not partisan appointees, about whether or not there should be some kind of recusal. But the fact is that it doesn't look like there's actually going to be. They made a point to say that that statement was sort of a general message. Yes, we will consult with these ethics lawyers, without saying it was actually in response to any one particular issue. So it doesn't appear to me that he's going to recuse himself, even though he has expressed such an overt opinion about the matter.
Now, we've seen a brief from Justice Department officials making the legal case that, yeah, in fact, they can Matthew Whitaker can be appointed to this temporary post. As you say, if this goes to court, it could take a while. Do we have any idea of a timeline for the appointment of a permanent replacement for Jeff Sessions?
No, we don't. And as a matter of fact, it looks like there are going to be more cabinet officials who are given the boot before a new attorney general is named. There are a lot of names floating around there. There's, you know, Chris Christie, the former governor of New Jersey. We've heard his name. Jeff Landry, the attorney general of Louisiana. Pam Bondi, the outgoing attorney general of Florida. We've heard all of their names. But it's not clear to me that any of those people are sort of on a, you know, a sure path to the nomination. And the fact is, this White House moves pretty slowly at times, frankly, because they just haven't done sort of the staffing that other administrations have done a lot more quickly.
Talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill. Reed, you just teased that idea that there might be other departures. There's reporting that the president not happy after the elections, possible staff shakeups. Let's talk, first of all, First Lady Melania Trump, her staff person, effectively called for the firing of a national security official, National Security Advisor John Bolton's deputy. Unusual, a little bit?
Oh, amazingly unusual. We don't usually see the First Lady get involved, or as we call it, the East Wing, get involved with the business of the West Wing. The stark example is, you know, back during the Reagan administration, when Nancy Reagan had some real problems with Ronald's chief of staff, Don Regan, and eventually got organized to get him fired. But the fact is, we don't see First Ladies getting involved in public policy, and public policy at sort of the White House staffing level. And, of course, we also don't see the First Lady getting involved in National Security Council matters. And as you say, this woman who was dismissed was the number two at the National Security Council. Apparently, they had clashed over the First Lady's trip to Africa, which she undertook. Was that last month or back in September? Anyway, recently. This has been a source of some tension. And by the way, I should say, apparently Melania Trump is not the only person who clashed with this Deputy National Security Council member, or Deputy National Security Council director. She had also clashed with Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, and even with White House Chief of Staff John Kelly. So maybe there was not a lot of sad faces when she walked out the door.
And staying with security advisors and issues, Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen, President Trump has been unhappy with her performance in the past, talk that she might be on her way out, and one of her biggest advocates, Chief of Staff John Kelly.
Right. And now the two of them have worked together for a very long time. Nielsen was John Kelly's deputy as chief of staff when he first took the job before she was appointed to head the DHS, which, of course, was his old job. So John Kelly has been maneuvering to save Kirstjen Nielsen for quite a while now. It does not appear that he's going to be successful. And you know, if the reports are true that he is threatened to resign if she gets the boot, and this time, if he threatens to resign, that threat may be accepted.
I want to turn to, I'd promote, we would talk about leadership in the House and Senate. We know who a lot of the leaders next year are going to be as of basically today, right? Mitch McConnell stays on, Senate Majority Leader. Chuck Schumer, Senate Minority Leader. What do we know in the House so far?
Well, we know that Kevin McCarthy, the Republican congressman from California and the current House Majority Leader, has won election to become the House Minority Leader next year. He defeated a guy named Jim Jordan, who's one of the heads of the House Freedom Caucus, the group of arch conservatives, by about a 3-1 margin. So McCarthy won pretty easily there. There are a lot of conservatives who are very nervous about McCarthy. They don't think that he has sort of the ideological background that they want to see in a House Republican leader. But the fact is, McCarthy's worked for a very long time to raise money and get Republicans elected. He's a very affable guy, somebody who, I don't know, when I got a new job once and he texted me congratulations. You know, he's that kind of guy. But there's this sort of hints at the internecine rivalry within the Republican conference, tensions between, call them mainstream Republicans, and the hardest right, a faction that's probably about a quarter of the caucus. So that tells you a little something there. On the Democratic side, I haven't checked in the last 5 minutes, but they are voting today on whether or not Nancy Pelosi will be the next House Speaker, or will be, I should say, the Democratic nominee for House Speaker. They don't actually pick a speaker until they formally convene as the 116th Congress in January, but she is likely to win, basically because there's no clear opposition to Nancy Pelosi. There is no candidate who has come forward and said, I will challenge you and rally the votes to get behind, you know, somebody else. So Pelosi is sort of the only game in town right now. And until Democrats are able to rally around somebody else, she's going to be the only game in town. The interesting part of this is that there are quite a number of House Democratic candidates who either wouldn't say that they would support Pelosi. I had a couple of candidates that I talked to this year who ended up winning, basically refused to tell me who they would vote for Speaker of the House if Nancy Pelosi were on the ballot. And, you know, if they get to the floor, the House Speaker isn't just the person who gets the most votes within the majority party. The House Speaker has to get 218 votes, a majority of the members of the House of Representatives. And Democrats have a buffer there. They've got at least 232 seats. I think that's probably going to go up to 234, 235 by the time all the ballots are counted. So they've got a little bit of room. They can give some of their members a free pass to vote for somebody else, which is what we've seen some other candidates do in the last couple of years when she was on the ballot. But the fact is, she's probably going to have the votes. She is the Democratic Party's number one fundraiser by a mile and a half, and she's got the relationship. You know, I always joke that the big city machine politics, we've really seen them sort of collapse in places like New York and Boston and Philadelphia and Chicago in recent years. But the one that still exists is the D'Alessandro machine. Her Nancy Pelosi's father, Tommy D'Alessandro, was the mayor of Baltimore, built a big political machine, and she's still running the D'Alessandro machine in the House Democratic Conference.
We're talking to Reed Wilson, national correspondent for The Hill, looking at some of the week's top news in national politics. You can weigh in on this issue we're talking about now at 800-642-1234 on these congressional leadership positions. If you're a Democrat, do you support Nancy Pelosi as the once and future House Speaker, or do you want to see a change in leadership among Democrats? If you're a Republican, what direction do you want to see Kevin McCarthy take as House Minority Leader? Do you think they should have gone to a more conservative candidate like Jim Jordan? Would you have liked to see a change, which didn't happen in either party, in the U.S. Senate? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Reed Wilson of The Hill, catching us up on the week's top stories in national politics. We're staying for a few moments with the issue of leadership in the House and Senate. And we'll go now to Owen in Wyawega. Owen, hi.
Hey, Rob. How's it going this afternoon?
Good. How are you doing?
Great. So, yeah, I remember the Tea Party. I'm 40, going to be 40 coming up here. It wasn't very long ago, and I'm sure all of you that are contemporary folks that have voted this year, most of you probably remember the Tea Party, too. And Nancy Pelosi was a big threat to the Tea Party. The Tea Party made a lot of problems for Nancy Pelosi. I think using Nancy Pelosi again as the Speaker of the House is probably a bad move if we want to work in a more bipartisan, less polarized type of political environment going into the future here so we can get some things done. I think using the same people over and over again is redundant, and it's time for new folks like that young Kennedy to try to step up and work his way in. And he's probably going to appeal a lot to more of the demographic of younger voters this year.
Owen, thanks a lot for calling in. Reed, it's interesting on Nancy Pelosi, obviously a target for Republicans often in political ads. Online, you see a lot of people on the left wing of the Democratic Party thinking she's too centrist. And then you see opposition from some more moderate Midwestern Democrats who think she's too far to the left, and they want some generational change, too. All those different arguments against her, yet she's probably going to win.
Yeah, and Nancy Pelosi is one of these people who has been, you know, in the center of the public eye for a very long time. You know, she first got elected to Congress in the 1980s, got into Democratic leadership, correct me if I'm wrong, 14 years ago, I think it was. And, you know, anybody who spends that much time in the national eye is going to be pilloried as, you know, a bad guy, basically, and seen as some kind of hyper-partisan. And, you know, the funny thing, there's this big disconnect between how she is portrayed in Republican campaign advertising, where she's this perfect foil because she is not from, you know, the San Francisco area. She represents the city of San Francisco, that hotbed of, you know, crazy liberalism. And on the other hand, she's one of the more effective legislators that we've seen in recent years. And I'd put her on par with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell as just an incredibly qualified legislator who has a roster of accomplishments. You know, there are a lot of Democrats who say that the Affordable Care Act, love it or hate it, the fact is it passed, would not have passed without her as Speaker of the House. And there are some other things that that they credit to her or Republicans blame her for as well. So the fact is, you know, anybody who's going to be in the national eye for that long is going to be a target of political attacks. And the Democrats are, in fact, opening themselves up to a couple more years of that of those attacks by reelecting her. But again, she is their best fundraiser and she's probably their best legislative tactician.
We'll keep watching what happens there. I want to move to some still ongoing election issues now. Florida and Georgia. A lot of overheated rhetoric, I think, going on in Florida. And now we're seeing literally some of these recount machines physically overheating.
Yeah, that's a pretty crazy story, isn't it? I think that was in Palm Beach County. I read that in the Philadelphia Inquirer this morning. That there are actually some machines that have been used so much that they're now overheating. But that, you know, they're still counting votes in both Florida and Georgia. Florida is undergoing a recount. It looks like it's going to take another couple of days. And I think Palm Beach County has gotten an extension now to continue counting the rest of their votes. But, you know, we're hearing this sort of drumbeat from the Democratic lawyers who are going to court basically every 5 minutes, and the Republicans are going to court every 5 minutes, too, with their own motions. But, you know, the drumbeat is sort of count every vote. And this is something that goes back to the Florida recounts that we all remember to our own horror back in 2000, 18 years ago, when, you know, some of the same Democratic lawyers who were arguing Bush v. Gore are now arguing the race between Bill Nelson, the incumbent senator, and Rick Scott, the incumbent governor, and the gubernatorial candidates, Ron DeSantis, the Republican, and Andrew Gillum, the Democrat. Important to say that Scott's lead right now is narrower than over Nelson than DeSantis's lead over Gillum. If anybody wins, makes a surprising comeback, it would be Bill Nelson before it would be Andrew Gillum. But the fact is, there are at least thousands more ballots to count, overseas absentee ballots, military ballots. I think this sort of highlights something about the way Americans conduct elections. We tend to vote a lot by mail these days, more and more so, especially in states like Florida and Georgia and a bunch of western states. And the fact is, it takes a long time to count those ballots. You know, there are still races being counted out in California. I just saw a couple hours ago a Democrat had been declared a winner in a district in the Central Valley of California. So, yeah, you know, it takes a while to count these mail-in ballots.
One question, and we'll keep watching those stories. Reed, I know you and I aren't the official arbiters of what constitutes a wave election, but as you look at the results from last week and results trickling in, what are your thoughts on whether we just had a blue wave?
Yeah, so let me offer the case for and the case against. The case for is the fact that the House Democrats picked up more seats in last week's election than in any election since the post-Watergate election, more than 2006, more than 2008. Nobody would not describe 06 and 08 as waves. So in that case, add in, by the way, the number of governorships, including in Wisconsin, where Democrats picked up, they ended up picking up 7 Republican-held seats. Nobody would not describe that as a wave. Now, the counterargument to that is, well, in the Senate, Republicans actually picked up seats. They picked up at least one. If Scott hangs on in Florida, they'll pick up two. How do you call it a wave if it's a split decision like that? I would say that, you know, at the beginning of the cycle, we were looking at Democrats running for reelection in 10 states that President Trump won in 2016. And if you had told any Republican strategist that they would only pick up one or two or net one or two out of those states, they would have been real depressed. So the fact is, you know, Democrats did pretty much as best they could. The one possible bright spot for Republicans is in state legislatures. The Republicans lost about 300 seats, well, a little more than 300 seats across the country. I will note, by the way, that one of the very few states, I think I counted 5 states, where Republicans netted seats in state legislatures was in Wisconsin, right, where they gained a Senate seat. So on the state legislative level, yeah, Democrats picked up 300 seats, but that's only about a third of the number of seats that Democrats lost under President Obama.
And then finally, President Trump made this trip to France this weekend, meeting with European leaders. There's tension with French President Emmanuel Macron, President not going on a prominent military cemetery visit. Talk about some of what came out of that trip.
Yeah, it has not been the best week for the White House. But then again, I feel like I could say that in pretty much every week that they've been in office. President Trump got to Paris for this commemoration of the 100th anniversary of World War I, decided against going to the cemetery with other leaders, blamed the weather to begin with, then blamed the Secret Service, then blamed the notion that he would have caused a traffic jam in Paris. But it appears that the backstory is that the president was irritated, and he saw that how badly Republicans had done in the midterm elections, and spent all his time watching television at the U.S. Embassy in Paris, growing angrier and angrier that he had basically declared victory at a time when it's obvious now that he lost more seats than any Republican president since Richard Nixon. Well, I guess it would have been since Gerald Ford. But this was not a great. I think he was on the ground for 43 hours in Paris. His trip started with an angry confrontation with Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, and a phone call as he was heading over to Paris. And on the way out, Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, called out nationalism, which is, of course, the foundation of President Trump's agenda. And that was, a very public insult, if you will, in front of 70 other world leaders. And, and public insults are not something that President Trump suffers gladly.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Reid, wouldn't ask you to predict the future, but is there a shoe you're waiting to drop right about now?
Oh, I mean, we've all heard reports that Robert Mueller's team is prepared to issue more subpoenas and indictments, perhaps. I actually thought we were going to be talking about that today.
Yeah, me too, actually.
Mueller has tended to move on Fridays, so let's see what happens on Friday.
All right, Reid, thanks, as always, for joining us.
You got it. Sorry about the noise in the background.
Wasn't bad. Thanks a lot. That's Reid Wilson, national correspondent at The Hill. He was with us, I believe, from an airport for a look at this week's biggest stories in national politics. Coming up after the news, tea can be a great beverage to drink any time of the year, but when you can't shake that chill in this cold weather, it's maybe even a little better. We'll take a dive into the world of loose leaf teas with a Wisconsin expert, connoisseur, and just big fan of tea. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Sandra Day O'Connor recently announced that she's been diagnosed with dementia. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us for a look back at the legacy of the first woman to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court. First, cold weather is the perfect weather for drinking hot beverages. Maybe swap out the summer iced coffee for something warmer, break out the hot chocolate, some warm apple cider. Also, it's a great time to drink more tea. Whether you drink it every day or you want to, but you don't know where to start, we've got a tea expert here to teach us a bit more about making a delicious cup of tea. Anthony Verbrick is the owner of Matcha Tea Company in Madison. Anthony, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, we wanted to talk about tea because it's cold out and we want warm beverage. You like tea all year round, though. You don't wait for winter.
That's true. Every day is a good day for tea.
Yeah, what got you into tea?
I've always loved tea, even as a child. Drinking tea was always something that we did almost on a daily basis. Huh. So it just kind of progressed as I got older. And then as in my teens and 20s, I started seeking out, different teas and kind of started blossoming from there, so...
Over the years, I've had tea. I do coffee. I drink tea sometimes.
Yeah.
I've done tea from tea bags. I've done loose tea with a strainer. And definitely, it's more of fun. It's more of a ritual drinking it with the loose tea. It feels like you're doing something cool. Do we get a taste difference, a flavor difference, having it out of, fresher tea in loose form?
Absolutely. Tea bags are convenient. They're popular because they are convenient. They're really affordable. They're everywhere. And it pretty much makes up about 80% of the tea consumption in the United States. Loose leaf is far... The experience is just better. It tastes better. You're going to have an even brewing time. So a lot of times when people ask me at the shop about this, the answer really is people who do tea bags tend to oversteep them. So, you know, it's intended to be loose, ground up, and then just brewed really fast. One, two times. Whereas the loose leaf, you're just going to have multiple steepings. And it's going to steep a little bit slower because you have the leaf in its entirety. So
multiple steepings of the same strainer.
Yep.
Okay. So you know, I did that wrong already. I've been corrected on one thing. Yeah, talk us through. How do we make tea with a strainer? It doesn't seem that complicated, but what's the right way?
Well, with a strainer, you can make tea many different ways. The most simplest way is just getting really good water, a really good quality tea in loose leaf form, and just putting it in a cup and adding water. So that style is called Grandpa style. I love that name. But another way to do it is, what kind of teapot would you be using? Are you going to use a teapot or are you going to use a tea ball? I personally don't recommend the tea ball because the tea expands and you only have a small amount of space. So that's why a strainer in a teapot works well, like a mesh strainer. It's a little bit larger, allows the tea to expand, and you're just going to have a better experience.
Let's talk about different kinds of tea. Now, I know there's herbal teas. They're not technically biologically teas, but we can call them tea. That's right?
That's okay.
But let's start with the straight up, the black tea. There's a lot of variety within that category, as I understand it. Can you talk about the realm of black tea?
Well, black tea is a fully oxidized tea. They kind of range in flavor depending on where it's grown. And also there's multiple cultivars that are used, which will actually provide a different taste and flavor profile. You know, it's such a huge... there's so much to know about it. So with black tea, it is mostly consumed in the United States. It's what everybody looks for in, like, breakfast blends, whatnot. Lots of caffeine. But, yeah, it's...
And can we get into, like people do with wine or beer or coffee now, can we get into that level of detail with the black tea in the world as far as, like you said, where it's from and what kind of flavor profile it's going to have?
Yeah. For instance... there are teas from an area in China called, the area is Anhui or Fujian. These tend to have more of a floral and kind of fruity profile. Small leaf varietal is what we call them. Everybody's familiar with India. Assam tea, it's kind of malty. It has body. So these are, you would call, I guess you could liken them to like your Shiraz or Cabs or something like that. And then you have teas from southern India and Nilgiri region, which tend to be kind of brisk. They're great for iced teas. The United States even grows tea too. So it really depends, like wine, it's a terroir, you know, it's what's in the soil. How is it grown? What time of year is it picked? It's going to have a different taste. So... yeah, so many factors.
Talking about tea with Anthony Verbrick from Matcha Tea Company in Madison. Now let's go. You've got a little sampling of herbal teas here. And once you get away from the tea plant itself, there's just a huge amount of variety you can work with.
Absolutely. At Matcha, we make our own herbal blends in-house. So all the ones that I am showing you are the ones that I've created. And herbal teas are great. We're coming into winter season. You know, people are going to get sick. People are looking for a little bit of comfort. Some of these ones I do have, like turmeric tonic. Turmeric is really big now. We have ginger. We have black peppercorn. This one is amazing. And also I have another one. Here,
give a smell of this one called...
Turmeric tonic.
Turmeric tonic, okay. Well, that smells good. What's in there with the turmeric? Because turmeric by itself is a flavor. When I cook with turmeric, you got to have something else with turmeric.
It's pretty bold. It's pretty bold. So I balanced that one out with a little bit of lemon myrtle, some ginger, some cinnamon, some peppercorns, and a little bit of dandelion root. So.
Okay, yeah, and that sounds like a great kind of, my throat's getting kind of sore today, tea, right?
Absolutely. I would say that's more of a kind of an immunity booster, you know?
Okay.
The second one we got is Be Well. So this one is a chamomile-based tea with eucalyptus, mint, ginger, a little holy basil.
Okay, yeah, it smells like a good, I don't know, herb garden kind of.
A little bit, yeah.
In a teacup.
That one's good for the throat.
Uh-huh.
Well, we are going to be coming up on Thanksgiving, and a lot of us are going to be indulging in a lot of eating.
True.
And we won't be necessarily feeling too hot afterwards. So that Restore is designed to basically help with digestion. You know, it soothes an upset stomach.
What am I smelling here? It smells really good.
Yeah, that one is probably a blend of about 12 different things. The main ones are fennel, coriander, again, peppercorns, some rooibos. Everybody's familiar with rooibos, and honeybush.
But rooibos is that one. There's no caffeine in that,
that's
right?
Correct.
But is it still a tea plant, or is this another species?
No, it's actually grown. It's native to South Africa, so in that region. And it's just a bush that grows. It's green, and then when they oxidize it, it's red. So two different flavor profiles,
okay.
And we at Matcha, we use both, green rooibos and red rooibos.
Now, in my life, I've had herbal concoctions that were supposed to have some kind of benefit and tasted terrible. I imagine you're trying to go for something, even when you're looking, thinking medicinally, you want it to taste good, right?
Yes, absolutely. That is the number one goal when I'm making a blend, is to make sure that you're going to taste it and you're going to say, this is delicious, I want more. After that, I have a background in cooking, so I approach all my tea blends as if I'm making some sort of dish. Okay, you have your top notes, your middle notes, and your bottom notes. Which one are you going to start with and then work off of there?
Now, let's end by talking a little bit about ritual around tea, because I think that can be part of the most fun. I think about my grandpa coming home from the factory and having a little tea with a little splash of brandy or wine in it, or my wife will do like a milky tea thing, whatever, however people do it. That's part of the experience, right? Like
absolutely.
Making that time to make the tea.
Absolutely. And you know, it's all individual, right? It's everybody does it a different way, and that's okay. I think our approach is teaching people, seek out good tea, you know, seek out quality stuff. The experience is going to be a lot better. It's going to taste better, you know. As far as a little splash of brandy in there, we're not opposed to that at all.
It's a good place to leave it. Anthony, thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Anthony Verbrick, owner of the Matcha Tea Company in Madison. He joined us to talk about the basics of trying loose leaf tea and giving us some ideas of what to try this winter. Coming up, NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg joins us for a look back at the legacy of former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll talk about new data that shows a number of DNA matches have been made from the backlog of now-tested sexual assault kits in Wisconsin. First, former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor recently announced that she was withdrawing from public life because she had been diagnosed with what is likely Alzheimer's disease. She retired from the court in 2006 to care for her husband, who was then living with dementia. Sandra Day O'Connor was nominated to the highest court in the land by President Ronald Reagan in 1981. NPR's legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg was already covering the court and its justices. Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson spoke with Nina Totenberg last week about Sandra Day O'Connor's legacy.
Sandra Day, at that point, finished quite high in her Stanford Law School class of 1952. She was third behind another well-known jurist, William Rehnquist. What was their relationship like?
Well, this is one of the sort of myths of all time. It turns out that Stanford didn't rank its students, but she and Rehnquist were both at the very top of the class. We do know that, and she was the only woman on law review from her class. Their relationship, they were good friends, and they were seatmates almost from the time she began law school, at the age of 19, I might add. And they started dating, and they dated quite seriously for close to a year, it now appears. Although she always downplayed it, and he always downplayed it when they talked about it. She said, oh, we went to the movies a couple of times. But he actually went home with her to the ranch, met her parents. That did apparently not go terribly well. But after about a year, she broke it off with him. And they remained close friends. She was a master at this. That is, she could, in this case, end a romantic relationship with Bill Rehnquist. And they remained friends all of their lives. But at some point, he wrote to her that he wanted to talk to her about serious things. And in the follow-up letter to that, he said to her, to put it bluntly, will you marry me this summer? Now, nobody, not in the O'Connor family or the Rehnquist family, and certainly not the press corps, and nobody at the Supreme Court, as far as I can tell, knew about this proposal. And it took Evan Thomas, who has written a biography of O'Connor that will come out in March, I think, to discover this proposal in O'Connor's correspondence, which he had access to from her days as a young woman, and found this proposal in there, and it was just a delicious piece of of memorabilia, really. And there is some notion that Rehnquist is one of the people who suggested O'Connor's name for a position on the Supreme Court when Ronald Reagan was looking for his proverbial first woman to break the barrier at the nation's highest court.
And here is Sandra Day O'Connor talking with Terry Gross of Fresh Air about what it was like to be the first woman on the U.S. Supreme Court.
I felt a special responsibility on every issue, including that, because as the first woman, I could either do an adequate job so that it would be possible for other women to be appointed without saying, oh, see, a woman can't do it. So it became very important that I perform in a way that wouldn't provide some reason or cause not to have more women in the future. That was very important to me.
It's very hard today to remember what it was like when she was named to the court. First of all, Reagan had promised during the campaign that he would name a woman to the court if he was elected. And there were a lot of people within the administration who said, oh, that was just a campaign promise, and you don't really have to do that. There are some really unbelievably well-qualified men who you should name as your first nominee. And Reagan wasn't buying it. He thought this was a promise he should try to keep if he could. But there were precious few conservative women judges in the country at the time. And imagine this, Sandra Day O'Connor was not on the Arizona Supreme Court. She was on the mid-level appellate court in Arizona. She not only didn't know very much about federal appellate law, she wasn't even on the highest court in her own state. Now, she'd earned quite a reputation in the legal community. She'd been very active in bar association and judicial associations, and she traveled to other countries with a lot of fancy people who were going there to do things. But still, this was something of a hike for her. And she was rated qualified by the American Bar Association. But in an interview that she did with me, she conceded that this was, in some sense, an affirmative act by President Reagan. He wanted a woman on the court, and she was a perfect fit for him. It was very exciting when he named her to the court. For somebody like me, who even back then was covering the court, for years I'd been hearing people say, oh, there will be a woman on the court this time. There never was. And, you know, I'm covering an institution. I'm looking at 8 guys, and I'm looking at 9 guys, 8 of them white guys. Mm. If you were a woman back then, it was incredibly exciting, whether you were a Republican or a Democrat. And she comported herself so well, and she was such a quick study. The young aide who was assigned to brief her for her confirmation hearings was a 28-year-old kid named John G. Roberts, the current Chief Justice of the United States. And he could not keep up with her questions. She was a speed reader. She'd taken a course in speed reading, and she could just inhale information. And then from that, say, I want to know this, I want to know that, and he didn't have the answers quickly enough for her. And she was quite clear about that with him, apparently, according to Thomas's biography. And it's just a very amusing thing. So she gets to the court, and she is, despite her great acumen and independence, she is completely overwhelmed, not just by the work, that's enough for almost anybody, but by the avalanches of mail from women and people and organizations wanting her to speak. And the glare was on her constantly, constantly, constantly. And she always said that any misstep would reflect on not just on her, but on all the women that would follow. And if she screwed it up, she was afraid no other woman would be named to the court. So it, for her, it was a great relief 12 years later when Justice Ginsburg came to the court, and she said it was instantly the heat was off. So it's a very interesting perspective that people tend to forget about her.
We're talking with NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg about the legacy of former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. O'Connor recently announced that she's been diagnosed with dementia and is stepping away from public life. Now, O'Connor was often referred to as a swing vote on the bench, but she didn't like that label. What were some of the cases that made people think that she couldn't easily be pigeonholed as either going with the justices who were more on the left or on the right?
Again, you know, when she was on the court, this was a different time. The court was moving in a conservative direction, but it was not nearly as conservative as it is today. And she, and a few years later, Justice Kennedy, were often at the center of the court. So if you take the biggest hot-button issue, abortion, it looked for a while as if she had doubts about Roe versus Wade. But even in the first big challenge to Roe, she began pushing an idea that was only her idea. She had nobody else signing on to it. And that is that a woman should have the right to choose whether or not to bear a child, and that the state could not impose an undue burden on that. Now, that was a little less severe than Roe versus Wade, which was much more bright-lined categories of what the state could and couldn't do. And it gave states a little more wiggle room to pass regulations. As time wore on, the big challenge to Roe versus Wade came in the early 90s. It was her theory of the undue burden that prevailed. Two other justices, Kennedy and Souter, agreed with her about that. And then two of the more liberal justices agreed with most of that opinion. And there were five justices, clearly, then for upholding what they called the core of Roe versus Wade. What happens now? Of course, we don't know, because the last remnant of that decision, the swing votes, Souter, O'Connor, and Kennedy are gone now, and replaced in each case by much more conservative members of the court.
Nina, as we wrap up, what's your most lasting memory or impression of Sandra Day O'Connor?
You know, she really was the fiercest voice for judicial independence. When there were threats in the states to judicial independence, this is what she devoted herself to after she retired. That and the idea of teaching civics to high school students and junior high school students. But throughout her career, she was fierce in defending the judiciary and understanding what a political threat to that independence might mean. And she probably understood that better than some because she'd been part of the political bodies for part of her life. In a lot of ways, she was an old-fashioned conservative, somebody that thinks that the court should protect minority rights. That is, the rights of people who sometimes can't be represented in majoritarian bodies, but not to get in the way of majoritarian bodies when they're carrying out the functions that they were elected to do.
Well, Nina, thank you so much for spending time with us and sharing your memories.
Thank you for having me.
That was Central Time executive producer Judith Sears-Poisson talking to NPR's Nina Totenberg. They're talking about Sandra Day O'Connor and her legacy on the U.S. Supreme Court. She just announced that she was withdrawing from public life after an Alzheimer's diagnosis or a dementia diagnosis. You can hear more of that conversation at WPR.org. There are a zillion different versions of the board game Monopoly out there, and now it looks like there's maybe a new one, Millennial Monopoly, as in geared at the millennial generation. And the millennial generation seems to be rolling its eyes instead of rolling the dice. Here's millennial producer Chris Molina. Hey, Chris.
Hi, Rob.
Yeah, I wrote that earlier.
That was very good. I appreciate that.
So, okay, I'm trying to confirm this. Walmart is selling this. I'm not sure if Hasbro is behind it or whatever, but the product description is catching a lot of attention here.
So the idea is it's Monopoly for millennials, and instead of buying properties, you collect experiences, and it's all sort of made up of things that millennials apparently like. So instead of, you know, buying something, you go to the vegan grocery store, or you sleep on your friend's couch. It's like you took every millennial stereotype and threw it into one board game, and it is driving people crazy online. I've been looking at the Twitter reaction, and there are a lot of angry millennials out there. So if you see a headline about millennials are killing the traditional board game industry, this is why.
Yeah, it replaces Park Place with a three-day music festival. And then there's the picture of the Monopoly dude, you know, top hat guy with earbuds, sunglasses, a coffee, and a participation medal.
He's got the participation ribbon on.
Right.
So, you know, I'm envisioning a lot of older executives sitting in a room. And
what are those millennials like?
How can we make the most millennial thing possible? And they did, and sure enough, millennials hate it.
All right, well, someone or something is marketing this. We'll find out more. Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Rob.
This is Central Time.